You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
Hello, hello, all you everyday innovators out there. Tamara here. So I've got a question for you. Do you see yourself as an instinctual like Vin? Before you answer that, let me tell you a little bit about Vin. This is from my soon-to-be-released book, Innovation is Everybody's Business. You can pre-order it on Amazon right now if you want to. Let me tell you about Vin so you can figure it out. Vin speaks from the gut, sometimes unable to explain why he has the idea or how he knows something to be true. He brings incredible insights to the team because he's able to see patterns and trends before others. His team knows to go to him if they want the big picture or need to understand how things fit together. His innovative ideas are insightful and robust. So I wonder, is your highest value bringing connective innovation to the world like Vin? Go to our website, take the quick online assessment, find out. Link is in the show notes. Let's see if you're an instinctual like Vin. Actually, speaking of instinctual and connecting the dots, today is a real treat because I get to interview someone that I've been following for years for his forward-thinking mind and ability to connect the dots in insightful ways. Speaking of instinctual, one of the 9 triggers or styles of innovation. So I just have to warn you, I fangirl a little bit during this interview. I'm just going to own it because I think he is absolutely phenomenal, and he brings us so much value in this interview and the work that he does. And frankly, he doesn't really need an intro, but here's one anyway. The one and only Jeremy Gucce stopped by Inside Launch Street. You may know him as the CEO of Trend Hunter, a global crowdsourcing platform that helps you spot and understand trends. But did you know he's also a New York Times bestselling author and the author of the just released Create the Future, Tactics for Disruptive Thinking book? So you are hearing this basically as it's going live. We were one of the first to chat to him, which means you were one of the first to get the insights from him and this incredible book. This is a high energy, action-packed interview. So what do you say we get to it?
Jeremy, I'm going to fangirl a little bit on you. I'm so excited to have you here today, and I just can't wait for this conversation to get started.
Oh, Tamara, thanks so much for inviting me. I'm really happy to be on.
So tell us, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Well, I think people see Trend Hunter as it's this big place where people share ideas, and it's got billions of views, and it looks like this giant premeditated plan. But the truth is, as a kid, all I ever wanted to do was be an entrepreneur so badly. And I even had these little activities with my dad where we would go through every magazine, and we'd flip, it could be about any category, really, and we'd flip to the sections with new things, and he'd say, what about this idea, what about that idea, and what would the reader of this magazine, what would she think? And then we'd prototype out little inventions and ideas. And on one hand, that solidified my desire to, you know, be an innovator or an entrepreneur, but I could never quite figure out what I wanted to do. And so when I was working in innovation in a bank, my nighttime thing is I started coding Trend Hunter as a place for people from around the world to share ideas. And I did that in 2005, before YouTube, before Facebook. But truthfully, here's the secret, I was really just trying to find a little idea that would inspire myself. And I thought maybe some Trend Hunter in Europe or a Trend Hunter in Tokyo would submit this little thing that could become the business I'd run with. And I didn't expect that Trend Hunter itself would become the business. And so now here we are, and it looks like a giant premeditated plan, and you know, we're helping companies innovate, but guess what? It's all just an accident because I was just looking for my ideas.
So I have to know, I don't know if you used to spend, you're a little bit younger than me, but a lot of time in the grocery store, but I used to love when there was a delay in the line because I'd pick up all the different magazines and read through them, and it'd be like BMX biking, things I have nothing to do with, you know, or knitting or whatever. And I would just read them and get ideas, and it kind of bums me out that the magazine industry is dead compared to what it used to be because I don't have anything to read.
Well, that was the inspiration, is we would buy every random magazine as kids with my dad. And so actually when Trendhunter first launched in 2005, it was called Trendhunter Magazine. Mm. And that was the idea, was that people from every category could share business ideas. And you might be someone that's working in design or fashion, but your inspiration might come from technology or some other industry. And today, as we've sort of grown up, now we're a research company. We've done about 8,000 or 9,000 projects. And so often what brands look for when it comes to inspiration is, show me something from a totally different industry that could maybe play back and then, you know, push my team's thinking in a different direction, which actually kind of reflects a lot in the whole thesis of Create the Future as a book, which is that you get caught in your own path. So how do you break free and find the other paths of opportunity that might be so close within your grasp?
I want to ask you a question about what you just said, because I think it's important. You said caught in your own grasp, which is a great way to say that, right? You get stuck in a rut, you get repetitive. And I think the most recent stat I read was our thoughts are 96% repetitive of the day before. So like all we're doing is thinking the same things over and over again. What do you think keeps people in that place versus getting them to step out and start to think differently?
Well, tomorrow it's all about horse butts and rocket ships. You want to know more?
I do want to know. You know I do on that one.
Well, okay, I'll give you a story and then we'll start drawing it to the business of why it's so important to break from the path and find your inspiration. So if you want to know why you miss out on opportunities so close within your grasp, it relates to rocket ships and horse butts. And if I was really to explain why, it's that the width of NASA's solid rocket boosters are determined based on the width of two horse butts. And that seems impossible. It seems awkward. It doesn't seem real.
It just doesn't seem like they don't connect.
Doesn't make sense at all. But if you want to understand that riddle, you have to go all the way back to the era of the Roman Empire. The Romans had the biggest land, the biggest empire, because they patrolled the land with a two-horse Roman war chariot. The chariot tore up the highways throughout Europe, creating ruts. And if you were a little farmer, you might bring your little wagon through one of those ruts and break a wagon wheel. So pretty soon, people start making wagons the same width as those ruts, which are 4'8.5" inches wide, just like the width of the Roman war chariot. So then the wagons are all 4'8.5". We start making wagonways on railways that are 4'8.5". Pretty soon, the Europeans make the first trains on rails that are 4'8.5". American tracks aren't connected to Europe, but they put them on rails that are 4'8.5". Yeah. And there were little experiments with different widths, but then, you know, the reality is we just started all making every track everywhere for bigger, badder, faster trains on tracks that are 4'8.5" wide. So when NASA needs to move the solid rocket boosters from Utah down to Florida, they need to put them on a path that's 4'8.5" wide. And, you know, the actual rockets overlap the width a little bit, but it doesn't change the fact that the width of NASA's rocket boosters are the width effectively determined and linked to two horses' butts. That's weird, but it goes to show you that we are more dependent on our past decisions than we like to admit. And everyone wants innovation and change to happen, but most people don't break from the path. And in Create the Future, my goal was to dive into 7 of the different traps that kind of cause this phenomenon. But the metaphor of getting caught in the path is the one I stick to, because it doesn't mean you're not going to be successful. It doesn't necessarily mean you'll get disrupted, but we do get caught in our path. And that means we miss the opportunities we could have.
So, you know, I love that story. So thank you for sharing that, because I think it really lays out a couple things that you talked about. And one is the fact that, so we're dependent on yesterday and what we are decisions we made, but also that there's a cascading effect of yesterday's decision. So it doesn't just impact the railroads. It then impacts NASA, which maybe those boosters are or are not the most efficient in the size they are. I don't know. I'm not a scientist. But you know what I mean? Like, it actually transcends more than one linear decision. It transcends or cascades across a lot of different things.
Yeah. And, you know, even if you take your own career, anyone can look at their career. And, you know, before Trendhunter, I was running innovation at Capital One, which means I was selling credit cards. But how does that actually happen? Did I study that in school? No. But you kind of pick a major because you had a few extra courses. And then you interview for 4 or 5 jobs and you take the one that's going to pay you $2,000 more. And you think you're going to do something different. But then 3-4 years later, maybe you're an expert in credit cards. And so then you have a life event and you're making more money and now you don't switch, and it's 8 or 10 years in, and guess what? that's what you're an expert in, and it's tough to get to a different path. The idea, though, is that there are things you can do that open up more paths. So we make fewer big decisions in life than we think, but there's ways you can open your options along the way. And in the career metaphor, well, that one's a bit easier. You could go back to school. You could go to conferences. You could bombard with people in different industries, etc. There are things you can do. But in your own career, the bottom line is there's just a lot of things that force you to repeat decisions. And one of them is that we make fewer large, impactful decisions than we give credit to.
So let's dig into your book, because this is the path out of the rut, right? So it was an interesting approach to the book. So it's really, I guess in a lot of ways, two books in one. So, you know, it's funny, as I wrote my questions to you, by the way, at first I put on the front side is this and on the back side is this. And then I thought, well, I guess it really depends on which side you pick up first, right? Nice. So on one side is create the future, tactics for disruptive thinking. And then from the other side in is the innovation handbook. Talk to me a little bit about why you did it this way and what people can expect to gain from a book done like this.
Sure. So the Create the Future Tactics for Disruptive Thinking is 100% all new. And then the Innovation Handbook is a totally rewritten, remastered version of a book I wrote a decade ago called Exploiting Chaos. And Exploiting Chaos was a handbook for innovation. And I put it out in 2008, right when the world became chaotic. And in a way, that was my big break as a speaker consultant, because the world got chaotic, yeah. And I was this chaos guy, so I started getting invites from Fortune 500 CEOs to help them in their chaotic times, and you help one or two, then you get to help five, and then 10, and then 50, and then 100, and now it's been a couple hundred CEOs. So that was my big break, and I was in the right spot, so I'm a little bit lucky to have written about chaos in that time. However, if I re-looked at my framework 12 years in, 700 clients later, I think the part that I felt was really missing was this idea about change. So the Innovation Handbook gets into how you create a culture of innovation, how you trend spot, how you adaptively innovate, how to message your idea. But the missing part about change is that I realize in my practical work of trying to help people through their problems that half of the problem is getting into that mindset to not repeat the past decision. And you and I can have a big creative exercise and innovate some new products and ideas, and all this can be wonderful, but there's just hundreds of examples riddled throughout history of companies that invented entire industries or technologies that disrupted themselves because they don't take their right. awkward new little ideas seriously.
So I want to dig into, so I read it, as I told you, and I want to dig into some things that really stood out to me, and I think we're positioned in a new and very accessible way. But before I do that, was there anything in this, as you were putting this together, particularly the Create the Future part, which is newer to your point, or even rewriting the other part, that surprised you or stood out to you? It was like, oh, I didn't expect this, but now that I'm doing the research and pulling it all together, this really makes sense.
Well, I think what sort of as a bigger thought about it is that I think that we've reached an era in time where everyone gets that innovation is important. Everyone wants innovation to happen. But most people don't break from the path in part because of tactics. And so what I was really trying to do, I think the part that would surprise the readers for sure, but for me, the sort of turn I took between the last book and then the total rewrite of this, is trying to think more tactically. So let's take failure. People say, oh, tolerate failure. Failure leads to good ideas. Cool, but I don't want my big project to fail. Like maybe the other guy, but
sounds
like—
sounds good, but no thanks.
And so what I've been trying to collect for almost a decade from our clients would be, what are the simple tactics to do that? So with failure, our client at Adidas, Mick Lussier, he will host a project funeral to celebrate your idea that didn't work out. At Staples, our client who runs innovation there, Brian Copeland, will give you a written permission slip that says, it's okay for you to fail on this project. We know you're doing the riskier thing, so don't worry about your bonus. We've got you covered. And there's all these little things that I think would surprise people, but the key message is that there's a decade of books out there that say now's the time for innovation and disruption. What I'm really trying to help people with is to create a handbook of tools and tactics to just get in how you do that.
I want to ask you a question about the failure, because I think I hear a lot from my clients too, that we must fail fast. We have to fail forward. We have to, you know, fill in the blank with failure. And you can see the sweat running down their brow as they're saying it, because to your point, nobody really wants to fail, right? And I think the other layer to that is sometimes they, in the way they set up the process or the system, they set it up so the failure is massive and public. And that's, you know, kind of another layer to it. How do you inform or help your clients think about how do we make failure not just okay, but in a way that's actually digestible, right? Because you can't have a, nobody wants the $50 million failure in the marketplace, right? There's like little things you can do along the way to fail and make that failure more valuable than that big at the end.
Well, there's a section that I get into, which it's funny because when I say it, it sounds so unsexy, but I assure you it's really cool. And it's the portfolio management of innovation and creativity. So thinking about innovation like a stock portfolio. And the reason why that becomes so important is because in your stock portfolio, you or the CEO you're trying to sell and convince is used to having some high risk bets that might not work out, some medium risk, some low risk, and kind of acknowledging the uncertainty, but in relation to a grander goal. And that's a more accessible metaphor in some ways. So if I give you an example, Smith Corona invented the laptop word processor, the spell checker, saving onto a disk. And in 1990, they were selling laptop word processors in the stores. And by 1991, the markets became a little rough. And so then they told the computer team, stop it, come back and work on the typewriter business. And you can return to this in a few years. 3 years later, they declare bankruptcy and the joint venture partner they abandon, Acer, goes on to become the second largest PC maker in the world. Wow. The thing about it is that if they managed innovation like a stock portfolio, they would have looked at their little tiny computer division and realized, well, that's part of our higher risk bets, so we have to keep it in there, and it might be failing now, and we've got other stuff going on, but you can't remove it. And the other little things that are neat about your investing is, my background, by the way, is I was a chartered financial analyst, so I try not to make it too nerdy, but I'll tell you the parallels. There's a couple psychological things that happen to gamblers that are related to investors and even more related, I think, to innovators. And one of them is called house is money. So house is money comes from the casino era. You're gambling, you have a big win, and all of a sudden you gamble with even higher risk because you feel like you're playing with the house's money. It's not yours. Let's gamble harder. And the opposite of that is called the snake bite effect. If you have a really big loss when you're gambling, all of a sudden you'll become irrationally conservative. And this happens in investing and it happens in innovation.
Interesting.
If you think about innovation and gambling and your stock portfolio the same way, you realize you need a bit of a measured approach. We need some high risk ideas. We need some medium. We need low risk. And you kind of get a bit of a different mindset to how you'd actually approach creativity.
Interesting. It really, I don't want to say it takes out the fear, because fear is hardwired into us from our primal days, but I like the idea of the balancing of the risk, or at least the perceived balance, I guess. It's not actually, I don't know if it is or isn't real, but yeah.
Perceived balance and just a total acknowledgement that the high risk projects have a much higher risk to them, and that's part of the game.
And that's okay.
Yes. And part B is, if you really want that to work, you have to find a way to celebrate failure. To dive a bit deeper into that project funeral example, celebrate and digest what happens when a project doesn't work out, because then you can put the idea to rest, you can move on, you can ensure the team's still motivated, and basically create an atmosphere where at all levels people acknowledge that there's some level of experimentation that's okay.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. As you were saying that, it reminded me of a project I was working on. It was a joint venture with a food company in Europe, and we were bringing this food over here, and it was a juice with apple bits in it. Not an American behavior, right? We don't like to drink our food. Super common in Europe, but just not for us.
Yeah.
The thing that struck me about it, and I think part of the reason it failed, is first of all, we didn't own the uniqueness. They were too afraid to let people know they were going to get apples in their mouth when they were drinking it. So trial was great, repeat was not. But also, they attached the milestones of the core brands to this. So the core brand is X dollars, billions of dollars. So therefore, this little brand with a whole new consumer behavior should hit the same numbers as the big. And it made no sense because it to your point, it didn't acknowledge that, hey, this was a high risk, different path than what we've done with this other brand.
Yeah, and actually, I'll give you another fun example. You'll hear people toss around, you know, names like Kodak and Xerox and Blockbuster Video, but I've actually interviewed all of those people, and it's been quite surprising to learn. So at Kodak, I interviewed Steve Sasson, who invented the digital camera in 1975. What surprised me is that the guy loved his job. He got to go to work every day, try new things. He invented the digital camera in 75. By 76, he had a paper on how we could share pictures over the phone lines. By the early 90s, they had a website where you could upload pictures of your face on the internet to share socially with your friends. But we know the outcome, right? It obviously didn't work. So here's the neat part. It relates exactly to your example with the food. The issue at Kodak is that the core brand value was revolving around the perfect Kodak quality print and beating Fuji. So he was allowed to do whatever he wanted. However, they're not going to roll out and commercialize it until it makes a better Kodak quality print than Fuji. And that kind of thing doesn't happen with a new tech. So he gave me this quote and he said, "A company's great culture can be the seed to its own destruction."
Oh, that's wonderful. I mean, those of us in innovation are like, yes.
Right? But in the company of Kodak, they don't
But I do think, I mean, it's kind of a lot of people talk about success is your ultimate downfall, right? But that really brings to light how that translates, because I think we hear that a lot, but don't really understand what that means in terms of how we operate and how we act. And it kind of leads me to the next question I have for you is, one of the things you talk about in your book, in fact, is the title of one of the pages is Disruptive Ideas Move Slowly Until the Knockout Punch. And I just love that. And I will just share very quickly with you that I used to do a lot of work for Clorox, and I'll never forget being in the conference room with them when OxyClean Orange Glow was coming on the market. It was an infomercial. It was this crazy dude at 2 o'clock in the morning. And they were like, yeah, no, this is nothing to worry about. It's a stupid infomercial, whatever. And then $300 million in that tire market share later, that's when they started paying attention. It was a whole different story. So it kind of resonated with me when I read that. But I want to hear you talk about kind of how this happens and how you go from, you know, this kind of came out of nowhere path.
Sure. Yeah. So 20, 30 years ago, there's a Harvard study, and it broke down the three stages of disruption. And it's interesting because stage one is that there are small little awkward companies all over the place, and they're super niche, and they take away from whatever your basic market is, but only tiny little people, so you don't even care. So for Smith Corona, let's stick with that example. There was Atari, and there's all these little video games, and then this is a computer that's super awkward, used for people that are nerds in coding.
I was one of those nerds.
Me too. I was a coder.
I went to Atari computer camp twice.
I love it.
So.
so what happens then is that Smith Corona wasn't worried about you, and they weren't worried about me because it's tiny. And that's your first stage, is that it's these little ideas that are kind of in your market, but not really. Stage two is that company starts to get a little bit of more market share, but they get the clients that don't matter. So in Smith Corona, the clients that mattered were the big corporate accounts, the individuals. Well, who cares? It's fine. Then I think everybody in management can get those two stages. Oh, I expect that. Okay, some companies get bigger. Stage three is the one that people don't realize, and it's called the knockout punch. And stage three is when that medium-sized company gets acquired by one of your rivals, or when they make a giant partnership, or they get a really big deal that suddenly takes them to the level that's 100 times bigger. And that's when companies get disrupted, because your competitor acquired them first, and now they're just so far ahead, and they have all the same resources, and then you're done. So the exercise to get out of that does involve trend spotting and learning how to see the potential in ideas that still seem awkward. When the iPhone came out and was revealed by Steve Jobs, I put a collection of a dozen quotes in the book that were all the quotes from the billionaire CEO of Palm, the billionaire CEO of BlackBerry, the billionaire Steve Ballmer at Microsoft. And what's wild is that when the first thing comes out, you see the Apple and you're like, well, the iPhone looks okay maybe to the consumer, but it's awkward. If you're Palm, you're like, well, we've been doing day planning for years. Theirs is
right.
Awkward. It's not going to work.
New.
We won't
yeah.
figure out the networks and how to make a deal with Verizon. And this is the issue. So stage one, tiny little niche. Stage two, they start to take your competitor or your lower end value customers and clients. And stage three is the knockout punch. And your way out of it is to try and find, assume more potential in the awkward little ideas that are in your market.
Here's my question about that, because I think that oftentimes that awkward idea isn't just a competitor that does it better. It's something that actually disrupts how that business is done. So take like Dollar Shave Club, which turned razors into subscriptions relative to the razor blade model that all of us in consumer packaged goods grew up learning was the ideal model, right? Or you take a Keurig relative to just regular coffee makers or Uber to taxi, whatever it is. How do you think about not just recognizing competitors that may be an interesting version of yourself, but also the disruptors that are, to your point, I love the way you said that, ideas that still seem awkward, that are actually going to change the business fundamentally?
Yeah. So in the Create the Future side, there is a section where what I sort of dive into is how you break out by trying to look at your problem from different perspectives. So get into the psychology of myelin and how we get caught in a groove and how, you know, we then can't see ideas on the fray. But the challenge is looking at your problem from different perspectives. So an example workshop that we do with different clients would be, let's pick five companies that are very different than you, and let's just look at how they'd approach your market. Mm. And you could take Amazon and Facebook and Patagonia.
Right. Doesn't have to be in your field, like right. Completely out there.
Right. And so Amazon, what if they bought your largest competitor? Well, guess what? Amazon's a bookstore. They won't. Well, they bought Whole Foods. That surprised people. That caused $20 billion lost market share among all the grocers in an hour. So What if they did? And then Google, what if they got in trouble with ads and they couldn't, because of privacy, use ads and they needed to get into consumer products and they decided to pick 10 markets to dominate? Yours was one of them. How would they approach it? Patagonia, they think everything you do is evil and bad. How would they look at your market in order to make something sustainable with ethos to save the world? Now, the idea of this sort of exercise is more simply to look at your problem from different perspectives. And when you do that, you start to see where you're strong and where you're weak.
Right.
And by putting yourself in the shoes, you're a competitive player. You can do a scenario game. And by putting yourself in those other shoes, you start to think about how you'd tear your company apart. But more simply, you were just trying to break out of your neural pathways to look at your problem from different angles.
Well, that's what I'm glad you said at the end, because I think there's two levels of value in what you're saying. One is that type of exercise that gets you to see differently. But the second part there is really about opening up your mind to think differently. And I often find, and I think this is what you're saying, is it's almost easier for me to innovate when I'm like, what if Amazon did this? Versus if I just sat in my bubble and said, well, what does Launch Street do? You know?
Well, there's an exercise it's probably my favorite in the world. And it's called the alternative use case test, and it's from the 60s. But applied to innovation, here's how it would go. You take an everyday object, and I like using a paperclip. Mm-hmm. And I say to an audience or a workshop group, what can you do with a paperclip? But let's do this live. And they'll come up with some ideas. And I know what ideas they'll come up with. They'll say, you can pick a lock, you can make a weapon, eject a SIM card, you can trade it maybe for a house. You can have a necklace or an earring. Cool. Buy yourself something nicer. But the point would be that I let them do the exercise. They get 10 to 15 ideas. And then I put my next slide up and I show them the exact ideas they all just said. And about 90% of the time, I'm 100% right with my guess. and otherwise, maybe there's one or two that are off. And I've repeated this 100 times. And why that's interesting is the average group of adults gets to 10 to 15 ideas and they're all the same ideas. But the average kindergarten kids, when your peak creativity hits at age 5, the average group of kindergarten kids can get to 200 ideas. And when you see that in a paperclip exercise, it's fine because it's simple. It's paperclips. You don't care. Right. You're not making paperclips. But the idea was to illustrate how we go back and the way our mind works is that we try to repeat and suggest the ideas we've already seen. And it's not a function of you not being a creative innovator. It's the fact that that's how your brain works. And so the only way to get out of your myelin pathways, which cause you to repeat your thinking, is to look at your problem from different perspectives, to break out of the normal pathway. So that's why all this stuff is actually more useful than you think. And in part, you're doing an awkward little workshop and pretending that Google or Amazon's entering your market to disrupt you. maybe you'll get a new idea out of it. But the other thing you're doing is training your brain to break out of the path to be better at actually looking at your problems from different perspectives.
Yeah. And I think what we kind of often don't realize is we've got this primal brain, right? Which is this bouncer that's like, let's keep out anything that's new, different, unique, right? We want it to be familiar. And the brain is shockingly, I don't want to say lazy, it wants to be efficient. So it says what it knows. And so I love that exercise you're talking about because it really forces you out of that in a way that's more about discovery than it is about like the stress of I have to find that right blue sky idea. Because I also think that stress of I got to leap 100 feet out of the gate is too much.
Should we do a nerdy neuropsych moment for your listeners?
Let's do it.
Okay. So we're not going to ask you to do a million things. We're already pretty deep into this podcast. So if you're still listening, just one tiny exercise will show you how your brain works. And basically, here's how it works. Once you get good at something, your brain makes its new neural pathway. And if you start practicing and practicing, it paves that pathway with myelin. And myelin's like a little highway that shows your neural impulses where to go. And it's white matter, and it's 40% of your brain. The more and more you practice, the easier it is for you to do the same thing, and your myelin pathway can make you 100 times more efficient at whatever you've put your 10,000 hours into. So the easy example would be as fast as you can, cross your arms. Fast as you can, cross your arms. Very quickly, just try it.
I'm doing it. Yeah.
Okay, you got it. Yep. Now, uncross your arms, just dangle them around. Okay. And now as fast competitively as you can, very, very fast, cross your arms the opposite way. The exact opposite way.
Which is funny because I'm super competitive, so.
Right?
Now, it feels super
awkward. That's not a mind-blowing exercise, but what it illustrates on a simple level is when you just cross your arms, it's easy. You naturally do it. You don't think about it because you've done it 1,000 times. But you're surprisingly step-by-step when you try to do it the other way. You have to think about where things fit together. And that's very simple. That's just crossing your arm. When we get to your job and what your career is focused on, a more complex task, that same activity cycle in your brain causes us to become repetitive, protective, stubborn, complacent. Yet it also makes us very, very fast at doing what we need to do on a routine basis. So this is the trade-off, but understanding how your brain works like that, you can also learn the ways to break out of those pathways, think disruptively, and then therefore be better at seeing those ideas that are so close within your grasp, but maybe you're just not seeing because of all the habits and things that keep you bound to the path you're already on.
You know, the other thing I really appreciate about that, Jeremy, is that I think it gives us, and as leaders in particular with teams, a little more permission to recognize that sometimes it'll feel frustrating at first, maybe a little bit awkward, maybe a little bit challenging. So crossing my arms the other way was super awkward, oddly enough, right? So, but knowing that I'm creating new pathways and that it's going to be harder and I don't have that myelin to make it super efficient out of the gate gives me a little bit more permission to play in that space a little bit longer.
For sure. And, it's interesting because when we think about what one studies in business school, if you for anyone listening that did that pathway, we have core courses like accounting and marketing and finance, got it. And then you get in the corporate world and there's a whole degree system and a certification system. And we have an accountant, we have a CFO, we have a CEO, we have a CMO. But innovation and adapting is not something that exists at every company. It's not a field that's just part of every university. It's not as regulated. And unfortunately, that means that people kind of wing it and they go out and they don't realize that there are so many tactics and tools that can lead you to the next level. And I think that the wave that we're going to see and experience in the next 10 years is that people have already now come to the age where they realize innovation and disruption is a part of everyday life. So the next step is how do we become a bit more scientific and widespread about making sure everyone is learning some of these tactics that are proven and that work.
Well, and the reality is, as technology takes over a lot of the baseline of work, being innovative, adapting, being able to find opportunities, as you talk about, which I want to ask you about, is becoming cost of entry for jobs at all levels. It's no longer a matter of like these three people get to innovate and the rest of us keep our heads down.
Absolutely.
I want to ask you about environmental cues because, I'm sure I've just done all the studying like I have too about behavior change and like how cues lead to habits and triggers and whatnot. And you said in somewhere in the book that boring workplace will lead to boring ideas. I want to ask you about that. I want to know kind of actually from two levels, one from the kind of overarching level of how do you create an environment? And then the second one is, as an individual, if I'm sitting in my cube, what can I do about my environment? So kind of one at the company level, one at the individual level.
Sure. Well, the core of what we're talking about is how one gets caught into a groove. And so if you're going to break out of that groove, there are things that are tactical and little that you would need to do to actually signal change. So in the original book, Exploding Chaos, now the Innovation Handbook, but I'll explain why I'm referencing the history of it, I put in the story of Louis Gerstner turning around IBM. And this is thought of as the greatest turnaround in management history because IBM was losing $1 billion a quarter and it was about to shut down and crater dramatically. And Gerstner took it over. It's in the book, How to Make an Elephant Dance, is his book.
Uh-huh.
But what's interesting, when he looks back at it, he says that in turning it around and bringing it in, changing it into a services company that it is today, culture wasn't just a thing, it's the only thing.
Yeah.
And when he dives into culture, he talks about how the most significant thing he did to make a change was that he put out a memo, one of only two emails he sent to the whole company, that showed here's the old word that we're using and here's the new word. We used to say account, now we say customer. We used to say 98% certainty, now we say 80-20. And it was a list of these banned words in the new vernacular. And what's interesting is that, as a side note, he got this email that was from someone in Europe suggesting they never saw this message he sent. And he found out that his SVP in Europe didn't forward the message to the European. So he called the guy and said, hey, can you please take the jet and get to headquarters for a meeting next week? The guy flies in, walks into Gerstner's office, and Gerstner said, hey, you didn't forward the email that I said about the new languages and words to say. And the guy goes, yeah, I didn't think that was relevant for Europe. He goes, never block an email that I send again. Okay, you can get on the plane and go home now.
That's like a mic drop moment.
So this is very important. And I had a chance after Exploiting Chaos to be part of probably a career highlight journey, which was helping Tony Hunter, CEO of the Tribune, turn the Tribune from bankruptcy to the most profitable news organization in America. And that story stood out to him a lot. So he actually changed the list of words a little bit. And one of the tactics was that he actually put posters around his office that showed the old words and the new words, just trying to get people to adapt. Now, we're talking about one little tactic. There's a lot of different things that you can do. And the idea, though, that's a bigger takeaway, is that to make change happen, whether it's as an organization or on an individual level, you really need to do actual little things of change that signal to everybody that change is happening. And sometimes those little things, like saying this word versus another, could be discounted. And certainly the IBM SVP in Europe discounted the idea, didn't think it's good. But that's the beauty of innovation, is that it's possible, it's tactical, but you're trying to use methods and little things that could sound fluffy, but that add up to have real impactful change.
Well, and I think the other layer of that too is in that story is that, we often get into, I think, a launch and abandon where we're like, okay, here's what we're doing. And then, we do it once at a town hall meeting or team meeting, or we send an email, whatever it is. And then we don't follow up to show that this really matters and that this is actually what we're doing moving forward. And having those posters on the wall, not just changes the cues in the environment, which changes the behaviors, right? The triggers.
Yeah.
But also it reinforces on a very visual insight basis that, hey, this is what we're doing.
Yeah. And so in my time, so I spent 4 years at Capital One running innovation there. And I got to grow them a $1 billion business, which sounds good, but still finance banks and credit cards. So just sorry, apologies for that. But one of the things that we were trying to do to launch our new business was create love and to tap into more of an upmarket group of people who don't simply need a credit card. People like you, you're successful and you need something that shows love, passion, that connects, whatever. So part of the problem that we'd realized was internally, we use languages like account. And so similar to the Gerstner thing, we had a whole series of things to immerse you in the customer. And it was now the customer. And we had rooms where the calls were being played. And we had the custom dashboards, which would show, you know, anonymized, but Johnny just purchased this here. Like, but trying to make it seem real, to connect one from their corporate office to that end consumer who's actually using what it is you're creating. And those real little things can add up.
So the other part I wanted to ask you about in Create the Future is the battle-tested method to create the future. And one of them that I wanted to make sure we didn't miss was opportunity hunting, because I think that's so powerful. Talk to us about kind of how that works and why that's so important.
So this has been the core of what a lot of Trend Hunter has done over time, was using crowdsourcing to have collected hundreds of thousands of ideas and think about how to filter those for brands. So within the book, this is where I probably offer something that's a lot different than what people might expect. And to give you a couple highlights, I'd say that the number of ideas that you generate, the number of good ideas, does become directly proportionate to the number on the output end that actually can turn into something that you can pursue. But how do you get those ideas? And so it's important to develop a system where you're learning how to collect ideas from the fringe, from your consumers, from the complaints that you get, from the curiosities that you have, that you're actually collecting ideas and then putting them into a filtration process. Mm. In our innovation assessment now of about 35,000 innovation leaders, we found that about a third say that they don't share ideas with their managers. About half don't have a system for regularly collecting ideas. Some of this stuff is simple, but the question to a listener would be, if you have an idea, where does it go in your company?
Yeah.
If the admin has an idea, if the person listening to the customer complaint line has an idea, where does it actually go? And if you can connect the dots and make sure you're receiving as much of that insight as possible, and then on a routine basis, thinking of how to filter them, you can get to your breakthrough. And when it comes to filtering them, you're going to take me on a bit of a tangent if I go too far, so I won't go. But when you look at all of your ideas in one place, there's a danger that you can still start to see the patterns you're expecting. So in Create the Future, there's a part where I go through an exercise of how would you design a hip hotel? And what happens is if people just do that exercise without stimulus, you come up with big, broad ideas. It'll be luxurious, and it's in the mountains, and it's
right.
Personalized, and it's vague. And then if you expose them to a whole bunch of trends and say, what are the trends that we're seeing in hip hotels, then certain trends jump out. And you might see, oh, there's ultra luxury and there's sensationalist hotels. Cool. Now, here's the catch. The first patterns and trends that you see from a group of examples are related to what you were expecting to see exactly in your industry. So some of the biggest insight comes from gathering your ideas in one place and then forcing yourself and your team to look at the same examples and see more pointed specific things that could then lead you to
right.
an insight. So we walk through that process in the book, but as a company, that's the profession of about 100 people that work on my team. So I hope that when readers go through that, they'll find ways to look at the ideas that they already have within their companies and then see how to unlearn and then relearn the different opportunities that might be in front of them.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite parts of the book, actually. And I just have to share with you, because I think you'll understand this. I was doing a couple years ago, I was doing a keynote, and I was talking about innovation feedback loops and just that you need to not only collect, but need to communicate back to your team what happened to those ideas, to your point. And this woman raised her hand and said, I don't get it. I have an idea box, whatever it could have been technology driven, but it was a place to collect ideas. And I said, okay, well, what happens next? And she goes, well, sometimes I read them, sometimes I don't. They just aren't very good. They're shit.
Right.
And I said, well, then what? And she said, well, and that's it. I'm not getting any good ideas. And, you know, I don't mean to mock her because she meant well and she asked the question, but there was a whole section of that missing, which was people feeling valued and heard in that process, kind of to your point earlier of this like void. And I think what I'd love to get your perspective on this, what I've seen, and I'm sure you've seen, is that when that void exists in hunting and collecting, people stop because they just don't know what happens.
Yeah. So, there's two things that really jump to my mind when I hear that person's story. And the first is that if ideas are sort of collected, but there's not that feedback loop, then what starts to happen is that I don't want to submit ideas because I think they just go to die and I never see something come back. Yeah. And then I'm not going to suggest something. But the second thing that's very important, one of the traps I get into is called the subtlety of disruptive ideas, is that let's imagine you have a given consumer product and you sell a grocery product just for fun. You know that the next generation of consumer is the younger millennials or even Zs. So you know they're different than the people that are leading the company. Everybody right. gets that. So there's going to be new consumer needs. Got it. The idea that's suggested for them is probably going to come from one of those millennials or Zs on the team.
Right.
They're brand new in their career and they don't know how to refine things. And they're going to suggest something that's going to look awkward in how it's stated. And so then you're going to see that idea come and it's so easy to be like, oh, we tried something like that. Oh, that's not really well filled out. And the issue is that all those first concepts, the first digital camera, the first day organizer, the first whatever, looks awkward. And the idea suggested sounded dumb. But someone along the line had to see potential in the awkward idea. So your goal as an innovator is to train yourself to be better at seeing the potential in these diamonds in the rough.
So I want to, before we have to close out, because I cannot believe we're almost out of time, I don't mean to be doom and gloom here, but I do want to paint a picture of consequence for a second. Because as you said in the very beginning, I think we all know we need to innovate. So now the matter is how, what do I do? Like, how do I get out of these pathways that you were talking about of the same old, same old?
Sure.
Before we kind of, you give me the advice, what is the real consequence right now for not innovating in the world that we're in today?
Well, it's total disruption. And the stat that I find so interesting, it's a combination of two things that totally conflict each other. On one side, we know the average lifespan of a Fortune 500 was 75 years in the 1950s, and now it's fallen to 15 on its way to 8.
Yeah, yeah.
And we know that if you look at the Fortune 500 list from the year 2000, 52% of the companies are gone or displaced. However, the opposite side of this is that the latest PwC survey says that 97% of CEOs, 97, say innovation is one of their core pillars. It's one of the five things they do best. It's in their DNA. They're good at it, and that's the differentiator from their competitor. That's an impossible connection. How do half of the companies get disrupted when every CEO says that they're on it? And I think that that's your consequences, disruption and missing out and watching your competitors excel beyond you. And maybe you don't go bankrupt as a company, but you're still making typewriters when you could have been making the computer. And so that's the weird disconnect that we're still seeing. And I think it relates back to that core point that everyone wants innovation to happen, but not everyone breaks from the path and not everyone puts effort into the tactics and tools that are proven that would actually lead you to be better at seeing those new ideas.
Which is great, because those proven techniques and tools are in your book. So on that, where can people go to buy the book and learn more?
Well, I suppose they say in stores everywhere, so certainly Amazon. But if you want more info, you can go to createthefuturebook.com. And there is a little section there where it shows you how, but if you forward your receipt from anywhere to us, then we'll hook you up with all sorts of free goodies from Trendhunter, like free research, free reports, frameworks, and some of the tools that go beyond the book for free.
Well, that is brilliant. I don't have a receipt. Darn it. I will go buy it again, and then I will have a receipt.
Oh, I'll find out how to help you out.
All right, Jeremy, this has been fantastic. What is your final piece of advice for all of us everyday innovators on Launch Street?
Break rules, push harder, act sooner, and never give up because you're capable of more than you think.
I know we're supposed to end, but I have one question for you because that's awesome on the breaking the rules. I love that. And do you find that a lot of the rules are there just because they're there, meaning versus serving us?
Well, a million years ago, we were hunters in an eat or be eaten world. We're nomadic. We can hunt and find new ideas. But 10,000 years ago, we planted the first seeds around the world. And wherever we planted seed, that's when populations started to flourish. And now, after 10,000 years of evolution, we're pre-wired to repeat and optimize whatever led to last year's harvest. So that means in companies, we put in rules, policies, procedures, structures, brand standards to preserve and protect whatever's happened before. So if you wish to find your next level and evolve, you have to break out of that 10,000-year-old mechanism or even that 1950s mechanism for controlling a company and figure out what are the rules you need to break in order to get to that next level. And actually, that's the traps of success are one of the sections of the book, and we have an assessment that we put, I think I referenced before, about 135,000 people through, and you can actually find out which hunter instincts and farmer instincts impact you the most, what type of innovator style you have, and there's no right or wrong answer, but what's cool is then you can figure out, you know, where would you fine-tune yourself to extract better thinking from your teams and get to those levels. So that's also at createthefuturebook.com. You can get the link to the free assessment from there.
Isn't that what created the Great Dust Bowl? We kept tilling the same land, right? I'm not a farmer, so I'm not sure if tilling is even the right word, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is the problem. And then you see how that takes place in modern day corporations, yeah. That mindset as well. We lose our hunter instinct because hunters seem reckless and likely to lose the farm.
Great. Nicely said. All right. What a great way to end. Jeremy, thank you so much. This has been so insightful. And for everyone out there on Launch Street, please go get the book. It is absolutely fantastic.
Thank you, Tamara.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, launchstreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.